WashingTech.
There are currently over 2.8 million students across 74 different districts, and the large majority of them, 55.8%, are African American and Latinx students.
Welcome to the WashingTech Tech Policy Podcast.
The latest tech law and policy news and brightest tech law and policy experts wherever you are.
So you can stay informed, on the move, in less time.
From Washington, D.C., it's the WashingTech Tech Policy Podcast.
With Joe Miller.
Joe Miller.
Elizabeth Warren blasts Facebook for enabling Trump by refusing to remove political ads that make false claims. Does Facebook have an enforceable ethical responsibility to fact check? Also, can Congress keep up with the public's demand for intervention when it comes to online extremism? And Aura Tanner is my guest. Hey everybody, Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign targeted Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg this week in a new social media ad. The ad facetiously alleges that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has endorsed Donald Trump for president. The assertion wasn't true, of course, but that was the point. Warren says that endorsing Trump is essentially what Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg are doing by allowing politicians to post false ads on the platform. In recent weeks, the social media giant has refused to remove false ads from politicians. As recently as Friday, Facebook declined to remove a Trump campaign ad questioning presidential candidate Joe Biden's alleged role in ousting a Ukrainian prosecutor after the Democratic National Committee called for the ad to be removed. Facebook is uniformly refusing to take down false ads, claiming to prioritize freedom of expression over truth. But Zuckerberg has also been defending himself for meeting with conservative groups, politicians, and pundits in private dinners and in other gatherings. Zuckerberg's terse response to those who criticized the meetings was, quote, "Meeting new people and hearing from a wide range of viewpoints is part of learning. If you haven't tried it, I suggest you do." Zuckerberg is set to return to Washington on October 23rd to testify before the House Financial Services Committee, which is chaired by Maxine Waters. According to a recent Morning Consult poll, some 58% of Americans want Congress to take a more active role in moderating online content. But the efforts of Democrats in Congress to push for legislation to curtail online extremism are getting resistance from civil liberties groups, including NYU's Brennan Center. The Hill reports that the Democrat-controlled House Homeland Security Committee is pushing for a bill that would create a bipartisan 12-member commission with the power not only to study online extremism, but also to subpoena certain communications. Civil liberties groups oppose any expansion of government surveillance, stating that such surveillance could have a disproportionate impact on vulnerable communities, such as communities of color. Meanwhile, online extremists who used to post on 8chan until it was shut down have now been migrating over to Telegram, according to a new Vice News investigation published last week, finding that more than two-thirds of the 150 extremist groups on Telegram were established this year. And extremist content on YouTube shows few signs of slowing. A violent parody of a movie surfaced on YouTube in which Trump's image is superimposed on a shooter inside a church, massacring his political opponents. The video emerged at a pro-Trump event hosted by the conservative group American Priority on a Trump golf course. The president stated that he strongly condemns the video, but that he hasn't seen it. Coincidentally, on Friday, before the event where the video was shown, Trump had stated at a rally that there is an, quote, unholy alliance of corrupt Democrat politicians, deep state bureaucrats, and the fake news media, end quote. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill last week that prevents the police from using facial recognition in body cams. The bill remains in effect until January 1st, 2023. New Hampshire and Oregon have passed similar legislation. Finally, in a case that carries significant implications for every online platform, the Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal from a lower court ruling that a blind customer can sue Domino's Pizza under the Americans with Disabilities Act for failing to make its website fully accessible. Fast Company reports, though, that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is pushing back, saying that allowing customers to sue can open the floodgates of litigation and thereby harm small businesses. And you can find links to all these stories in the show notes and also in our Twitter feed, and our handle is at WashingTech. Stay with us.
WashingTech, the inclusive voice of tech policy. Because America won't stand still for the same old insiders. WashingTech, moving the needle.
My guest today is Aura Tanner, fellow at the Aspen Tech Policy Hub, assistant director of the Office of Undergraduate Research, and PhD candidate at the University of South Florida. She previously worked as a nuclear physicist, science educator, and more recently as a graduate researcher on NSF-funded grant projects related to digital game-based learning and assessment. Aura earned her bachelor's and master's in physics from Dillard and USF, respectively, and expects to complete her doctorate in instructional technology and educational measurement this year. She studies the latest emerging technologies and explores how they can be used to empower both K-12 students and teachers in science education. Please welcome Aura Tanner. Aura, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Joe. I'm glad to be here.
So in the wake of last year's Parkland, Florida shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School, which took the lives of 17 people, the largest high school shooting in U.S. history, the Florida legislature passed a bill that took effect earlier this year requiring school districts to use a data collection tool called the Florida School Safety Portal to assess the violent threat levels posed by certain students. So to start, what does this tool do exactly? How does it work?
So basically, the Florida School Safety Portal is a centralized integrated database. And what it does is it flags students whose behavior they believe poses a threat to themselves and others, specifically if that student is on the pathway to committing mass gun violence. And so just a little bit more of how it works is the student is flagged, they put their name into the safety portal as a query, and then it pulls all this information from all of these multiple databases like Department of Children and Families, Florida Juvenile Justice, law enforcement, local law enforcement, disciplinary records, social media monitoring data. And then threat assessment teams at the schools along with law enforcement are able to look at this information, and then they determine how they would like to intervene with that student.
So how many students, Aura, and how many school districts are we talking about here? And what are the demographics of Florida's students?
There are currently over 2.8 million students across 74 different districts. And the large majority of them, 55.8%, are African American and Latinx students.
Mm-hmm. Don't necessarily reflect the demographics of a lot of the shooters. What are the key problems that you see with this tool?
There are actually a number of issues with the portal. One, it's not evidence-based. So there's no research to show that using integrated data for surveillance or even to predict a shooter is possible. And also there was a lack of input from the community. So we didn't hear from teachers, parents, students, technologists, just a lot of the stakeholders as to, do we want to approach mass gun violence this way? Is technology the route to go? There's a lack of transparency around this data portal. So we don't know exactly how students are flagged, what happens once they do get flagged, how the student's information is being protected, and more importantly, what the decision-making models are. Like, how is it determining this person is a threat? And one I'm personally interested in is the bias. So a lot of these data sets they're pulling from are highly correlated with race and socioeconomic status. The algorithms themselves can have bias because of who's making them. And the people normally making algorithms don't look like the students they're going to be making decisions about. And then there can be bias in the observation of the data. So on these threat assessment teams in law enforcement, if they have not been trained in implicit and explicit bias, just viewing the data, there can be some bias that creeps in there as well.
And so when we look at that data, what are your recommendations for as a physicist, as a PhD who's done a lot of research in this area for Aspen? What do you see? What are your recommendations for improving the data collection and assessing these kinds of threats before they happen?
Forecasting future behavior is extremely difficult. So I recommend that policymakers work with technologists, such as those who are experts in statistical modeling, computer scientists, those who work with integrated data systems and machine learning, as well as researchers such as myself, other experts in data security, privacy, and community stakeholders, such as civil rights and advocacy groups, mm-hmm. and collectively coming up with a solution to mass violence in our schools. But overall, more research is definitely needed as it relates to using technology for school safety.
Absolutely. And I'm surprised that they didn't seek the input and take a more data-driven approach before they began implementing this program.
Yeah, it was mostly, I guess, the governor, the legislators, and law enforcement. But in light of the shootings that took place, I guess it's kind of like a reaction. We have to show we're doing something, we're handling this problem.
So where does this intersect with tech policy?
Well, in order to address these shortcomings at the policy level, I've done several things. The first thing is I wrote an editorial that was published in the Tampa Bay Times. And I did that to raise awareness about the safety portal with parents, students, and the general public in Florida about the implications of this tool. Also, I did a public comment at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission meeting, and I was able to highlight the research that I've done on this and to point out the social implications as well as policy implications, and also ask them to consider recommendations I've made in an operational plan that I wrote, which basically calls for oversight through transparency, accountability, and fairness. I've also written a policy brief, which I hope to get before more stakeholders, and some other things such as one-pagers for parents and students so they can just get a quick overview about this. And I plan to put all these things together in a technology policy toolkit so that I can ultimately meet with the Commissioner of Education and the Governor of Florida to try to get an amendment to this part of the bill.
Well, Aura, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Obviously, a lot to sort through here. Definitely need to make a careful balance between protecting students and then also not over-indexing with children of color who are students and who are not predisposed to commit any crime whatsoever. And, you know, if history's any guide, not put them in a position where their data is being collected sort of like a panopticon disproportionately compared to white students. Now let's turn to the icebreaker. Okay, what band or music genre would you be embarrassed to admit you listen to?
I wouldn't say really embarrassed, but probably would be surprising to a lot of people. But old school hip hop, like from the 1980s, like Run DMC, LL Cool J. Yeah, I probably know the words to most of the songs.
There you go. I'm definitely not embarrassed about that either. I am embarrassed about listening to disco sometimes, though. That is kind of embarrassing. What are you reading these days?
Just in light of my recent work I've been doing with this project, I've been revisiting a book called Right to Petition by Nicole Tisdale. And it's basically a practical guide to creating change in government using political advocacy tools. So it's really great at helping you take action on the work that you're doing. So I encourage your listeners to check it out.
Well, thanks again, Aura, for joining me. Do you have any final ideas you'd like to leave with the audience before we close? And where can folks find you online?
Yes, definitely. I'd like to ask anyone who's interested to help me push for accountability, transparency, and fairness with the Florida Schools portal. And you can do that by emailing questions about the safety portal or providing public input through links that will be provided with this podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at OD Tanner and LinkedIn at Aura D Tanner.
And you've been listening to Dr. Aura Tanner, Tech Policy Fellow at the Aspen Tech Policy Hub and PhD candidate in instructional technology at the University of South Florida. Aura, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much. It was great.
That concludes episode 205 of the podcast. Thanks so much to all of you for listening. If you like what we do here, we'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment, head over to Apple Podcasts, give it a review. It helps others know what they can expect from the show and helps us out tremendously. Also, head over to techpolicypodcast.org and join the Washing Tech community. You'll gain access to our weekly newsletter, which is full of useful insights, analysis, a job board, and other stuff designed to keep you awake during tech policy debates. In it, you'll also find out about new events before the public. So join today. Sign up at techpolicypodcast.org. And I'll see you back here next week. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Washing Tech.